We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Back in the 70s, people made the same arguments against interracial relationships as they're making against same-sex marriages today. So I really strongly believe that in the next 20 years, we're going to look back on this and be sort of ashamed of the fact that we were against this, just as we are ashamed today that we didn't let people of different races get married.
That's North Carolina congressional candidate and former musician Clay Aiken making the connection, trying to draw the connection between same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. Now, is that a legitimate connection? Is it true that the same arguments are in play or that the debate is even the same? And when people try and make this case, what are they really trying to say? Joining us to talk about same-sex marriage and interracial marriage on this Thursday afternoon, Ryan Anderson, William E. Simon Fellow in Religion and a Free Society for the Heritage Foundation, co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense, and author of a recent blog post for the Daily Signal titled Seven Reasons Why the Current Marriage Debate is Nothing Like the Debate on Interracial Marriage. Ryan, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be with you.
What are those who advance this argument, that the two are equivalent, that to oppose same-sex marriage is as pernicious as the opposition to interracial marriage? What are they trying to say?
You know, I think they're trying to achieve three things simultaneously with this argument. I think one, they're trying to shut down the debate. We don't have a discussion about racism. We don't have a discussion about interracial marriage. Neither should we be having a discussion about same-sex marriage. So they're trying to smear people in favor of the historic understanding of marriage as a male-female union as if they're bigots and racists. So they're trying to shut down that discussion. I think second, they're trying to get the courts to redefine marriage. They're saying the court was justified in striking down prohibitions on interracial marriage, so too the court should strike down laws that define marriage as a man and a woman. And then third, I think they're trying to say that even in private life, we shouldn't allow people to run their businesses in accordance with their belief that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, just like we don't let racists run racist bakeries or racist photography shops. So too, we should force the photographer to take the wedding photos at the gay wedding. We should force the baker to bake the wedding cake for the gay wedding. And so they do this. I think they achieve these goals by trying to conflate the issues. And what I do in the blog post that you mentioned, it's based on a research paper I did for Heritage. I just show seven historical and philosophical reasons why these two debates are just not similar at all. They're really about as far apart as imaginable.
Now, you begin your case by saying that support for marriage, and this seems a kind of historical fact that is often overlooked or just considered irrelevant to the debate, support for marriage as a union of man and woman has been a near human universal. What do you mean by that?
Sure. What we know is that up until the year 2000, there was no political community on the face of the earth throughout all of human history that ever viewed marriage as something other than the union of male and female. While there are some societies that were polygamous, some societies that were monogamous, they always viewed marriage as a male-female relationship. And that this fact, and it's shared by the Christian, the Jewish, and the Muslim traditions, it's shared by the ancient Greek and Roman thinkers, Enlightenment thinkers, common law, canon law, civil law, it's a near-human universal, illustrates that it's reasonable, it's rational. This wasn't just a matter of animus, this isn't just an arbitrary position, that the history here is attesting to something about human nature, and then our intellects, our rational capacities, our reason can then grasp what that is. And that's the set of arguments that we make in the marriage book that you mentioned during my introduction. You know, we spell out in that book, here are the philosophical reasons why marriage is the union of a man and a woman. What I point out here is that all sorts of different cultures, not just the United States of today, but all throughout history, all across the globe, have recognized marriage as male-female as well.
Connected to that, you say that even cultures that have historically embraced same-sex relationships in some form or another didn't treat them as marriages. Take us there, if you would.
Sure. So you can look to ancient Greek, ancient Rome, other places where there was no major social prohibition on same-sex relationships. If you read through Plato's dialogues and some of his discussions of Socrates and some of the other Greek philosophers, there's a lot of same-sex sexual relationships going on. They didn't view any of them as marital. And so that's partly to show that those who argue that people who think that marriage is about a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, a mother and a father, are just doing it because they have an animosity towards gay and lesbian Americans. That can't be the case for historical reasons, because we know this to be true of the Greeks, but also we know this to be the case of other societies where the concept of homosexuality or the category of same-sex relationships wasn't even on the table. They also viewed marriage as a male-female relationship because of its capacity to create children and because of its ability to then unite children with their mother and their father. This has nothing to do with denying gays and lesbians marriage equality, the way that the opponents will frequently phrase it.
So the opponents are here trying, are basically doing a little sleight of hand. They're saying ancient societies were more enlightened than we are because they had fewer problems with same-sex relationships of every variety. But the sleight of hand comes in that they say that means that they regarded them as legitimate categories for marriage.
So you can think of it this way. There are two different questions in this debate, at least two different questions. One is the question of what is marriage? Then there's another question of what's the moral status or the moral evaluation of other types of relationships. And people can be totally in favor of same-sex relationships and still not think they're marital. I've seen articles with headlines titled "I'm Gay and I'm Against Gay Marriage," written by people who will recognize that, you know, the relationship they have with a same-sex partner isn't the same thing as the union of husband and wife, mother and father. And that the reason that we give marriage a special designation, the reason that we treat marriage uniquely in law, is because it plays a unique social function that other loving, committed, consenting adult relationships do not.
Keeping with the theme of history here, you also say that great thinkers, including the champions of human rights, understood that gender matters. What's that about?
Sure. So what we point out in our book is that, you know, we have this universal consensus that marriage is a male-female relationship. And then one of the things that I point out in this blog post is that these same thinkers didn't think it had anything to do with race. So if you look through Plato and Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Luther, Calvin, John Locke and Immanuel Kant, Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., some of the greatest thinkers in human history, many of whom are great champions of human rights, they all say that marriage is between a man and a woman. But none of them say anything about race with respect to marriage. So again, the parallel, when people are like, oh, you guys who think marriage is a male-female relationship, it's just like people who are against interracial marriage, that falls apart. Because every great thinker thought that marriage was the union of a man and a woman. None of them thought that the color of someone's skin had anything to do with marriage. In fact, we see that these sorts of bans on interracial marriage are historical anomalies that really come rather late in human history, and they're mainly based upon perpetuating the evil regime of race-based slavery. These bans on interracial marriage had nothing to do with people's thinking about marriage, and only had to do with people's lack of thinking about racial equality. These bans on interracial marriage are the result of racism, because they had to keep the races apart in order to perpetuate slavery. And then after slavery, to perpetuate white supremacy. This had nothing to do with the nature of marriage.
When we come back from this break, I want to pick up on that point that Ryan just made, that these bans on interracial marriage were historical anomalies. We'll find out more about that right after this. We're talking about same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. We'll be right back.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Leave it to the Lutheran Church to want all the discarded crap from evangelicalism and evangelical worship, jumping on that boat at the moment evangelicals are leaving it.
Craig Parton, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And it's my generation, the baby boomer generation, that frankly needs to die to leave all these entertainment orientation, market orientation, me orientation. What can the church do for me today? That kind of perspective in the Lutheran churches, which is really needs to be extirpated in some way.
You can listen to Craig Parton's presentation, Making the Case Against Lutherans Imitating Evangelicals, on an audio DVD from the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday afternoon, August the 28th, we're talking about same-sex marriage and interracial marriage with Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation. Ryan, before the break, you brought something up. I want you to expand on that, if you would, that these prohibitions, these past prohibitions on interracial marriage, were in fact historical anomalies.
Yeah, so let me, I don't know that. I mean, you can see in the United States, the U.S. colonies were the first political community in history to ban interracial marriage. Other communities throughout history have banned intermarriage on other characteristics, nationality, religious background, your tribe, your clan, something like that. The English colonies in the U.S. were the first ones to ban marriage on the basis of race. And the reason why, it wasn't because of some deep philosophical insight on the nature of marriage. It was because of the need to perpetuate a wicked regime of race-based slavery.
How do you respond to someone who says, look, just as marriage must be colorblind, it must also be genderblind?
Well, I would say it can't. It has to be colorblind, but it can't be genderblind because of what marriage is. So what we know is that the sexual difference between a man and a woman goes to the heart of what marriage is, whereas their skin color doesn't tell us anything about marriage. A man and a woman, regardless of their race, can unite in marriage, and children, regardless of their race, deserve a mother and a father. And so in order to make principled marriage policy, in order to have marriage policy that reflects the truth about marriage, we have to know what marriage is, and then we can determine that race is irrelevant to marriage, but that gender complementarity, the sexual complementarity of man and woman, husband and wife, mother and father, goes to the heart of what marriage is.
Talk a little bit about Loving versus Virginia, the Supreme Court decision that finally overturned bans on interracial marriage. What do we need to know about that?
Sure. What the Supreme Court said there was that there was no justification for laws that banned interracial marriage except for racial discrimination, and that the 14th Amendment was passed to strike down those sorts of laws. It was meant to get rid of racial discrimination. What we've now seen, Judge Paul Niemeyer from the Fourth Circuit that reviewed Virginia's marriage amendment, said that Loving simply held that race, which is unrelated to the institution of marriage, could not be the basis for the definition of marriage. He says, but you can't then stretch Loving's holding to say that therefore marriage can't have anything to do with gender or sexual complementarity. He says that to do this is to ignore the inextricable biological link between marriage and procreation that the Supreme Court and American law has always recognized. So it was right for the court to strike down interracial marriage laws, bans on interracial marriage, because they were violating the equal protection on the basis of race. But that you can't then stretch that to say the court should redefine marriage to make it a genderless institution.
So what are we seeing here? Are we seeing attempts on the part of those who advance the argument trying to draw an equivalence between interracial marriage and same-sex marriage? Are we seeing them – or maybe I should ask it this way. If they win the argument and they get a legal recognition that gender and race are essentially the same thing with respect to marriage, what have they proven? What might they not intend to prove?
I think what they're trying to do with this is to therefore get the court to redefine marriage. So they would like to say that if laws defining marriage as a male-female relationship are just as unjust as laws that were prohibiting interracial marriage, therefore the courts should strike them all down. And then they're going to say that the government should also require photographers and bakers and farmers, anyone who intersects with the marriage industry, the wedding industry, to leave their religious convictions about marriage at the door, and that the government will coerce them into treating the same-sex relationship as a marriage.
So then, if they manage to draw the legal equivalence between race and gender, or sexual orientation, can any characteristic be a legal basis from that point on for what they would say is discrimination? Age, you name whatever other characteristic you want to toss into that hat. Have they literally pushed it past the edge of the slippery slope to say we can't forbid marriage on the basis of anything, period?
Well, no. So it would just be on specified grounds. So right now, the movement right now is to add sexual orientation and gender identity. The acronym is SOGI, S-O-G-I, sexual orientation and gender identity. There's a push to have that added to existing non-discrimination statutes to say that if you can't discriminate on the basis of race, nor should you be able to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The problem here is that they use the phrase discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation to include a lot of things that aren't discriminatory in the kind of negative sense at all. So they would say that believing that marriage is the union of a man and a woman is discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. That would be the type of conclusion that they'll seek to draw from some of these laws.
You have three action items, and I want to talk about them in turn here with the few minutes left to us. You say marriage policy should be worked out by the people. What are you saying there?
The basic idea here is that we should not have judges insert their own policy preferences about marriage and then declare them to be required by the Constitution. What the court should be doing here is upholding the freedom of the American people and their elected representatives to make marriage policy. We don't need a court-imposed 50-state solution on marriage. What we should do is we should work out the definition of marriage democratically. We can let the laboratories of democracy the time and the space to think through this question.
You say the government should not coerce anyone into celebrating anyone else's relationships. What are you saying?
So the idea here is that regardless of how the state defines marriage, so even if a state does redefine marriage, there's no compelling state interest in forcing all citizens into celebrating the same-sex relationship as a marriage. The stories that we've seen with the bakers, the photographers, the florists, there is no need for the government to coerce them into celebrating the same-sex relationship.
And finally, you say that protecting religious liberty and the rights of conscience doesn't infringe on anyone's sexual freedoms. That's precisely the issue that's being advanced by the other side, that if you want to exercise your right of conscience, you will by default be infringing on my sexual freedom.
Not at all, because here's the beauty of liberty. Two people of the same sex in a relationship, they can be free to live with each other and love each other. No one's going to infringe on that relationship. But that doesn't mean that they have a right to have a photographer or a baker or a florist provide them with a wedding cake or a marriage bouquet or something like that. So protecting religious liberty, protecting the rights of conscience, says that the evangelical photographer, the Catholic baker, the Orthodox Jewish florist, they can run their business in accordance with their values and their lives, and the same-sex couple can lead their life in accordance with their values as well. It doesn't take anything away from them to not coerce the florist or the photographer or the baker. So in that sense, all Americans can be free to live and love how they choose, but they can also be free to act in the public square on their belief that marriage is a union of a man and a woman without fear of government penalty.
Finally, with only about 30 seconds here, Ryan, how, as you read the tea leaves, legal, political, otherwise, how close are the proponents of this argument, drawing an equivalence between race and gender, how close are they to winning that argument?
You know, it all depends on what people like you and me do. I think if we keep making the counterargument, if we keep showing why it's reasonable to view marriage as the union of a man and a woman, why the only coherent, intelligent understanding of what marriage is sees it as a sexually complementary union, we will win in the long run because truth will ultimately prevail. A lie can only win for so long because ultimately lies are self-destructive. But if people like you and me silence ourselves, if no one makes the case for the understanding of marriage that is the correct understanding, then yes, that argument will be a losing proposition. So it all depends on whether or not there will be compelling spokespeople for the truth.
Ryan Anderson is the William E. Simon Fellow in Religion and a Free Society for the Heritage Foundation. He's co-authored the book, What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense? And he's author of a recent blog post for the Daily Signal titled 7 Reasons Why the Current Marriage Debate is Nothing Like the Debate on Interracial Marriage. You can read this article and purchase the book, What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense? At our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Ryan, thanks for being our guest.
Sure thing. Happy to be with you.
Thanks to Jonathan in Saginaw, Michigan, Tamas in Ashburnham, Massachusetts, Anne in Mount Clemens, Michigan, Catherine in Sacramento, California, and Jeffrey in Oakmont, Pennsylvania. They all placed orders today for an audio DVD of this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. Now, non-conference attendees can order this audio DVD of more than 8 hours of teaching from Pastor Matt Harrison, Pastor Will Whedon, Pastor Chris Roseborough, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, Craig Parton, and Dr. Alvin Schmidt and me for a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day, September the 1st. Now, you can order online. Just click the audio DVD logo right there at our website, issuesetc.org, or you can order by check. Make your check for $300 payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. 3 more days for the audio DVD. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Professor Tom Egger about Joshua, and we'll play Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Cradled in historic Perry County, Missouri, the manger of the Missouri Synod, Emmanuel Lutheran Church at 453 Northwest Street in Perryville proclaims God's Word and celebrates His Supper on Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 7:30 and 10 using the church's liturgy contained in Lutheran Service Book, enriched with ancient and modern hymns. For more information, call 573-547-8317 or visit www.emmanuel-perryville.org.